All right, Mark chapter 3. Yeshua heals a man on the Sabbath. What a scandal. The conflict between Yeshua and the religious leaders is continuing to intensify, and this makes it all the more tense. All right, we read, Yeshua went into the synagogue again and noticed a man with a deformed hand. Since it was the Sabbath, Yeshua's enemies watched him closely. If he healed the man's hand, they planned to accuse him of working on the Sabbath. Yeshua said to the man with the deformed hand, "Come and stand in front of everybody." Then he turned to his critics and asked, "Does the law permit good deeds on the Sabbath? Or is it a day for doing evil? Is this a day to save life or to destroy it?" But they wouldn't answer him. He looked around at them angrily and was deeply saddened by their hard hearts. Then he said to the man, "Hold out your hand." So the man held out his hand, and it was restored. At once the Pharisees went away and met with the supporters of Herod to plot how to kill Yeshua. A wonderful miracle, and instead of rejoicing, hallelujah, it's, we got to kill this guy. Let's talk about Yeshua's opponents. There is already a pattern of opposition. Wherever Yeshua goes, there's a contingent of antagonistic religious leaders tagging along, looking for anything they can seize on, a statement maybe or some action by which to find fault with him. Well, now he's back in the synagogue, presumably in Capernaum, and they think they have another opportunity to accuse him of violating the Torah. So here's a man with a withered, I don't know if that means arthritic or just an unusable hand. He's there, and they're watching like hawks to see if Yeshua heals him. It doesn't even register with them. This is how hard-hearted they are. It doesn't even register with them that they're not wondering if he can heal the man, only whether he will. It doesn't even register with them. They're so hostile that they will not even entertain the possibility that Yeshua is the long-awaited Messiah and that these miracles are evidence of it. No, we can't have that conversation. Why were they so against him? From the divine perspective, Messiah had to be rejected by his own nation, resulting in his atoning death to make atonement for the sins of mankind. But from the human perspective, going back to the prophecy in Genesis chapter 49, these religious leaders, his opponents, are the Judeans who were supposed to hand off the scepter to Shiloh, to Messiah, the one to whom it belongs, but they were unwilling. And they can't very well just come out and say, "We like our power, we like to have this authority, and we're just not doing that." They can't just come out and say, "We love our power." So what do? Instead, they have to find some excuse, a pretext, to claim that he can't be the Messiah. Now we'll ask the question, does it actually violate the Torah to heal on the Sabbath? And by what logic is healing a person considered work? There is nothing in the Torah, I'm just going to tell you that right now, there is nothing in the Torah that prohibits healing the sick on Shabbat. But a bit of historical context is probably in order here. During the Jewish people's exile in Babylon, in the absence of the temple and in the absence of any kind of opportunity for the priests to offer those korbanot, the sacrifices, it was the rabbis who rose to prominence. And they de facto became Israel's gatekeepers. These rabbis added oral traditions to the law. They called it the oral law. And in some cases, it was so burdensome, and they were so numerous, and they were so fastidious about it all that it bordered on absurdity, and it became a burden for people. Yeshua often challenged the authority of these rabbis' so-called oral law, and this was a major part of the conflict, the ongoing conflict between Yeshua and the Pharisees and the other religious leaders. One of these oral traditions was a prohibition against giving medicinal aid on Shabbat unless the person was dying. Now, this twisted logic, I think, happens whenever religion becomes an end in itself and takes priority over people's needs. And it happens today, too. I mean, haven't you ever met somebody who was so theologically precise and so careful about doctrine, and yet they had little or no compassion for other people? When a man is healed from sickness on Shabbat and that is seen as a bad thing, something ain't right. Now, what was Yeshua's response? Notice that Yeshua summoned the man to come to the front. He is not afraid of confrontation. He is not afraid to take on this so-called oral law and all these traditions head on. He wasn't afraid to challenge and expose the hypocrisy of his critics. You know, there was another occasion in Luke chapter 14 where a man was healed by Yeshua in the synagogue on Shabbat. And at that time, Yeshua said, "Which of you wouldn't rush to lift your son or even your cow out of a pit if they fell in there on Shabbat?" Here he says, "Does the law permit good deeds on the Sabbath? Is it a day to save life or to destroy it?" In each case, they refused to answer him. Very telling. In each case, he was disgusted by the hardness of their hearts. And in each case, he healed the suffering person. And then it says that the religious leaders, the Pharisees, went off to conspire with the Herodians, the supporters of Herod. Who are these Herodians? The Herodians were a party of secular Hellenized Jews who felt that it was in Israel's best interest to show support for the policies and for the government of the Herodian family. Let's not make waves. Let's show support. Let's even be enthusiastic for the Herods, and maybe they'll leave us alone and give us more freedom. They were pragmatists. And as you might imagine, Herodians and very religious Jewish people were not seeing eye to eye. And so the very fact that Herodians and Pharisees were conspiring together, two groups that would never have anything to do with each other, that shows you how deep the hatred of Yeshua was and how deep their fears went. Now, Rabbi Lauren has wisely, with each of these sections of Mark, been saying, okay, how does that relate to us? And where are we in this story? We are like that afflicted man, okay? We are like the afflicted. We need a touch from the Almighty. And what do? Yeshua summons us. He's calling, right? He's calling to us. And we come forward. We come to Yeshua. And he meets our needs for healing and for salvation. But what's the upshot of it? Both religious Jews and secular Jews aren't happy about it. And Yeshua, and like that time, nothing has changed. Yeshua's messiahship is not even open for discussion. Minds are already made up.
Thank you, Rabbi Glenn. Rabbi Jerry, any thoughts?
I just think it's interesting here how we, like you were pointing out, the enemy is sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They see Yeshua as this deep political enemy. And again, it's people in power. I think it's interesting. We see these guys as opposite sides, but they're united in their desire to maintain power in the spheres that they have it. And I think we see the same thing today as well. We have different political parties in our country. There's different political parties around the world. There's different economic systems. And we see these things as all of them as divided. And they are, because each of them have their own perspective on things. But when it comes to the trait of self-preservation, you can get some very interesting bedfellows. Political parties are very quick to unite when it comes to preserving their own self-interests that cross those political lines. And so I think it's just something we need to keep in mind as we think about powers and structures and how our faith and really the gospel message challenges this establishment. You know, this is a message that doesn't just affect one political party or one economic system. This affects anybody who is a human being who wants to maintain power at the expense of God's word.
The Herodians represent political power, the Pharisees religious power. They were normally at odds with each other, but here they unite political and religious power. And when religious leaders and political leaders unite, it's either very, very good or very, very bad.
What would be a good example?
King David.
Right. Nathan, right? And Nathan.
And Nathan and the priests, they were all aligned. They were all serving the Lord with passion. It was like the spiritual high point in Israel's history. That's a positive example of, religion and politics uniting for good. Bad examples of religion and politics uniting, maybe when the popes were the political leaders of Europe and they launched the Crusades, went to wars again, for political gain, and also, the Crusades, which turned out to be so, catastrophic. Including for the Jewish people in particular. So that's a bad example of religion and politics uniting in a very bad way. The man with the withered hand. Your hand is so important, especially if it's your dominant hand, the hand that you use. Without your hand, you're much less effective. You can't do everything that you were designed to do. So humanity is like this man with the withered hand. We are not functioning the way we should be functioning. We are not doing everything that we should be doing. We need our hand healed. Humanity, Yeshua is the only one that can heal the man with the withered hand. We desperately, all of us, humanity, needs Yeshua to function the way God designed us to function. Rabbi Jerry, next section, the crowds follow Yeshua.
We read, Yeshua went out to the lake with his disciples and a large crowd followed him. They came from all over Galilee, Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, from east of the Jordan River, and even from as north as Tyre and Sidon. The news about his miracles had spread far and wide, and vast numbers of people came to see him. Yeshua instructed his disciples to have a boat ready so the crowd would not crush him. He had healed many people that day, so all the sick people eagerly pushed forward to touch him. And whenever those possessed by evil spirits caught sight of him, the spirits would throw them down to the ground in front of him, shrieking, "You are the Son of God." But Yeshua sternly commanded the spirits not to reveal who he was. So here we can see that despite plans brewing against him, Yeshua is still very popular. He has people coming from all over to be healed because they have heard of his ministry. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean that they believe his message, just that they've heard about this great miracle worker, and those who are sick want to experience this for themselves. They want to see his power at work. How big are these crowds? Well, we're told the general vicinity of where they come from, but we're also told they were so big that they were worried about getting crushed. That's a lot of people, a lot of very passionate people as well. And so this is a sign, again, sort of that this passion, these emotions have been stirred up by people that they need to get a boat to have an escape plan going on. Now, once again, we see that Yeshua not only has power over disease, but demons as well. And in certain cases, diseases and demons can be interlinked, and I think that's part of what's going on here. Obviously, not every disease is resulting from a demon, but clearly there was demonic activity at work here. So why does Jesus rebuke these demons? I mean, he is the Son of God, right? They're stating a gospel truth. Well, the truth is here is you don't want demons helping you out in any situation. If a demon came over and said, I wanted to paint your house, you probably shouldn't have them do so, right? Just because they're saying something intellectually true doesn't mean that their motives are pure. Again, they're demons. You don't trust demons. It's just one of those basic facts of life. And so they're throwing down the people. It's a sign of submission. They're proclaiming who he is. But there's an ulterior motive, which is the crowds, these huge crowds, passionate, stirred up, emotional. If they saw Messiah Yeshua being associated with demonic activity, this could negatively reflect on his ministry. And surprise, surprise, we're going to see that in the next passage, this idea of a connection between demonic activity and Messiah Yeshua. And so I think that's part of what's going on here. But again, Yeshua rebukes them. This is more than just telling them, hey, be quiet. This is the Son of God commanding them to be silent, and they are forced to. It shows his complete power over them. And he does not want them interfering in any way with his ministry.
Rabbi Glenn?
Very good, Rabbi Jerry. Just thousands and thousands of people are flocking to him and following him. The other day, I was driving up, maybe it was Woodward, or I was on one of the main roads, and there was this big line of cars. What's going on? And it turns out, and it was going quite a ways, I had to get into the next lane over to be able to keep going. Turns out that there was a gas station on the corner offering gas at $2.69 a gallon. And everybody's so excited about that they're willing to wait there 10, 15 minutes in line burning gas to get gas at $2.59 a gallon. And I'm thinking, okay, big whoop. You know, now show me gas at $1 a gallon, I'll wait a few minutes. But the point is, we get excited about something like that. Here are people who are coming because they have heard about many, many people being healed of diseases, being cured, being delivered of demonic possession. And they're hearing about it so much. Who wouldn't run, right, to get close to that person and to ask him for his power to be exercised to help you or to help your loved one? So you can just imagine the crowds of people coming to him. And of course, that same thing that draws the crowds to want to come to him is the thing that threatens his opponents. And so as we're going to see, with each ensuing chapter, the hostility against him is growing. And here we are. We're only in Mark chapter 3. They're already plotting to kill him.
Huge contrast between the average ordinary people from all over that area beyond the borders of Israel. Yeshua is having a tremendous impact on the entire nation of Israel and beyond. What a contrast between the attitudes of ordinary people and the religious elites who are hating Yeshua more and more, have already decided he's not the Messiah. We are rejecting him. We want to eliminate him and his influence. What a contrast between the multitudes and the elites. Yeshua was healing people of all kinds of physical diseases, illnesses, really serious problems, and casting out demons, evil spirits, fallen angels. This is the one that humanity needs, the seed of the woman, the Redeemer, who is going to undo all the evil and catastrophic things that took place as a result of the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. This is the healer of humanity physically and spiritually, and that's what he will ultimately do. Verse 13, Yeshua chooses the 12 apostles. Afterward, Yeshua went up on a mountain and called out the ones he wanted to go with him. And they came to him. Then he appointed 12 of them and called them his apostles. Apostle is a Greek word. It means one who was sent out, representative, one who was sent out to represent the one doing the sending. So these men will be representatives of the Son of God. They were to accompany him, and he would send them out to preach, giving them authority to cast out demons. These are the 12 he chose: Simon, whom he named Peter, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, but Yeshua nicknamed them sons of thunder, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who later betrayed him. Interesting that Yeshua went up on a mountain before he made this major decision of which men to recognize as his emissaries. Going up on a mountain is not easy. Have any of you ever climbed a mountain? Not like a little hill, but a mountain. Maybe about a third of us. I climbed a couple of 14,000 plus mountains in Colorado in my early teenage years. And those are memories I will never forget. And it takes a lot of effort to climb a mountain. And it can be dangerous. So it's very purposeful. It's very intentional. It's not easy. It takes effort. There's also spectacular views. You see God's handiwork, you know, this great, you know, a great panorama. You are very much aware, if you believe in God, how great God is. And there, it like has a way of drawing you closer to God. You're up there on the mountain, you know, close to God in heaven. And so Yeshua is up on the mountain. I think he is very close to his Father, hearing very clearly from his Father before he makes these very important decisions about his key men that he's going to choose. What was Yeshua's purpose for these men? They are going to represent him during his public ministry. They're going to assist him. They're going to help them. They're going to be in training. And they are going to carry on his public ministry after he leaves. So they're in training. They're helping him during his public ministry while he's there among them. And then these are the guys that are going to carry on his worldwide ministry of world evangelism and salvation. They are the ones that will organize and lead his community. They are the ones who will write down his teachings for future generations. They will begin his ongoing effort of world evangelism. These are 12, actually 11, of the most important human beings who will ever live. The King of Israel, Yeshua, promised these 11 men that they would sit on 12 thrones ruling over the 12 tribes of Israel one day. If they are going to be honored like that in the future, we should be honoring them as much as we possibly can in the present. We honor them by believing every word that they wrote. Why 12 men? Why not 10? Why not 7? Why not 21? Well, numbers can be important. The number 12 is important in the Word of God. It's connected to government, the 12 tribes of Israel. These 12 men, Judas is going to be disqualified and replaced. These 12 men will be the true leaders of the Jewish people. They will be the true leaders of the new Israel. Why did Yeshua pick 12 men? If he was living now, there would be tremendous pressure on him to pick 6 men and 6 women. Why 12 men? God has ordained leadership among human beings. We see this from Genesis all the way throughout the Bible. Men and women are different. God has designed them differently. God has entrusted leadership to men in the individual family and home, but also on a higher level in his community, which is like a larger family. We do not want to rebel against this very important principle of male-female differences, gender differences. God ordained authority entrusted to men in the family and in Messiah's community, this extended family. Do not rebel against this principle like the rest of Western civilization is now rebelling. Fight against it, resist it. It's destructive, it's wrong. It will not go well for you if you go along with the majority. These are all Jewish men. I'm sure if Yeshua wanted to, he could have picked some Romans, some good centurions. He didn't. 12 Jewish men. Why? Well, God had already chosen Israel for spiritual leadership among all the other nations. Israel is my son, my firstborn. That's the position of honor and leadership in the family. So God wanted Israel to bring spiritual leadership to the other nations of the world. Japheth will dwell in the tents of Shem. This is all part of that God-ordained plan and choosing. And I believe that when Messiah returns and is ruling and reigning from Jerusalem, not New York City or Paris or London or Beijing, Israel will again be like the center and the leading nation over the other nations of the world. And that will be a blessing for the other nations of the world, not a bad thing. A few more thoughts about the apostles. Yeshua did not choose the best educated men from the best academies in Israel, from the best rabbis. These were, for the most part, ordinary men. He did not choose the wealthiest, the richest, although it seems that James and John were from a well-connected family. They knew the family of the high priest and had access to the high priest, which was like, you know, the president of the United States back then. But most of them were not wealthy. They were not the best educated. They were not from the center of power, Jerusalem, but from the periphery. It seems that all of them were from Galilee. God uses and prefers to use ordinary men and ordinary women, not the elites, to accomplish his purposes and work with us and transform us and make us, make us fulfill our calling with the gifts and talents and abilities that he's planted in each one of us. That is his way of doing things. These men were faithful. These men were used greatly by God. What began with them, like this little mustard seed, would transform world history, especially the history of Western civilization. A few more thoughts about some of the apostles. Tradition says that Thomas, who is nicknamed Doubting Thomas, turned out to be very full of faith and brought the message of salvation the furthest of all the other apostles. He went all the way to India and started the church in India, which is a very ancient church, which is why many Christians from India are named Thomas, either their first name or their last name. Rabbi Glenn, any thoughts?
Yeah, a couple of things. First thing that you notice is Yeshua didn't say, hey, who wants to be an apostle? Raise your hand. Come on, let me see those hands. He chose them. He knows what is inside every man and woman. He knows. He made the choice. And as Rabbi Lauren said, he didn't choose what we would call the cream of the crop. Galileans were considered rednecks. Like, no offense to NASCAR fans, but it's like what people look at the NASCAR crowd. Oh, yeah, all these guys with their pickup trucks and the gun rack in the back, you know, and blah, blah. And people tend to look down on that. But these are the kinds of people Yeshua chose. Galileans, fishermen. One of them, Simon, a zealot. The zealots were like a almost equivalent of a terrorist group. They would go into a crowd, kill somebody, get a riot going, and because they thought that violence was the way to overthrow Rome. I mean, he's hardly choosing the cream of the crop. Matthew, a tax collector, you want to talk about the most hated people in Israel at that time. But then something else dawned on me. There's a parallel here, and there are so many of these parallels between David and Messiah, the son of David. Notice that he gave a nickname to James and John. He called them sons of thunder. Why? Because apparently at one point there was a town they came to that wouldn't receive him. And so they said, Master, should we call fire down out of heaven to destroy this city? And what does he say to them? He says, you guys don't know what you are made of. It's almost like, what is it with you two? Well, David had two very close friends and associates that he had the same kind of dealings with, Joab and Abishai, the sons of Zeruiah. On more than one occasion, he had to say to them, what is it with you two? Because they're always wanting to kill somebody, always wanting to get vengeance for David's sake. Even in this, the fact that two more hot-headed disciples or followers of David and two hot-headed followers of Messiah Yeshua, even in the little things, we are meant to see these parallels. He is the greater David.
I like that.
Couple of comments as well. I find it interesting, just on a very basic level, you know, he nicknames them the Sons of Thunder. Rabbi Glenn explained very eloquently why they get that nickname. But I think it's just interesting that Messiah Yeshua gives people nicknames. I mean, obviously Simon gets renamed Peter as sort of a prophecy or, an anointing on him of what he's going to be doing. But, you know, these guys, these like hot-headed guys, Yeshua clearly had a lot of affection for, and he gives a nickname to them. I just think it really shows God's affection for us. And even with some of our more maybe annoying quirks or just more difficult aspects of our personality, just as we can have a lot of fondness for people with certain issues, I think the Lord does as well. And, you know, he didn't try to stop them from being the way they were in this way. He just really tried, I think, redirect it and show him that he still loved him. But, you know, we talked about the calling of God here. You know, people are uncomfortable with God making decisions and calling people, even though that's throughout the Word of God, different types and people being called. But imagine if you were, so we have these huge crowds, and then he goes up on a mountain, and you're at the presumably foot of the mountain. There's some interesting imagery there. And he's calling out names of who his disciples are going to be. And you're going up the mountain probably to be with him. And you're waiting and hoping that your name is called. You know, you hear Simon, James, and John, Andrew. You're probably starting to question his choices in disciples, but you think he's probably going to get it right eventually, right? But your name isn't called. You know, there's a lot of people, I think, who were disappointed that day that they weren't called to be one of the 12. Now, God in his sovereignty, as we said, intellectually, we know theologically that he picked the right 12 for the job. But that doesn't mean that your feelings didn't get hurt. And I think there's a lesson for us in ministry and as leaders or just people that, you know, sometimes when we make right decisions, it can still lead to people's feelings being hurt. But just because somebody's feelings are being hurt by a decision being made doesn't mean it's the wrong decision. And so there can, obviously we can hurt people's feelings in a wrong way where we need to apologize to them. But sometimes when your feelings get hurt, you need to check them and say, you know, should I really be as upset as I am about this? You know, it's valid to feel, you know, bad not to be called as one of Messiah's chosen 12 disciples, but you can't blame Messiah Yeshua for that, right? In the sense of, you know, holding it against him. In the same way, I think we have to be very careful with our own feelings to not let them police us. I know a lot of pastors and rabbis who will make good decisions, but then either start walking them back or trying to find a loophole because somebody they really care about's feelings get hurt by the decision. You know, imagine if Messiah says, well, you know, I have 12, but, you know, so-and-so seems really upset. Let's make it 13. Maybe we could go up to 14, right? It's, you laugh at that, but that's a lot of times how we can approach some of these decisions as well. And so I think there's a lesson here, a principle in making decisions in a godly way and then sticking with them if it's the right way to do things. Just to add that.
And if I could add, be careful what you wish for. You want to be one of his apostles? They had no idea at that time when they felt honored that they were being called to eventually lay their life down. Almost every single one of them died violently. So be careful what you wish for.
Good thoughts. We got to come up with a nickname for Rabbi Jerry.
Why do I have a nickname? What about you two?
I've already got mine, so I'm covered.
And I know a lot of you call me various things.
Wait, what do you call yourself? The doom and gloom rabbi?
Is that that's what? Puddle glum. I like that.
Puddle glum, the marsh
puddle
wiggle.
Glum.
Yeah. We'll figure something out at some point.
Thank you, Rabbi Jerry. Thank you, Rabbi Glenn.